Work it out per rectangle. 10,000 per ring? Yes, and we have more square meters per person than you have. I did a quick calculation. Each rectangle contained 36 rings, so 36 times 10,000 is... heavens. 360,000. I hadn't expected that. It made each rectangle a complete city. But, then, it was also a lot of land. How long is the rectangle? Roughly 10 kilometers. I judge that the width must then be in the region of 6 kilometers, so that an area was then 60 square kilometers and therefore my solution must be 600 people per square kilometer. I was certainly mistaken about your population, 600 per square kilometer. That's double ours. I was under the impression that it was much less. When I see the space that you have left, I must admit that it is a very clever solution. Your answer amuses us because you have made a small mistake. You have the decimal point in the wrong place. I calculated again and came to the ridiculous total of 6,000. It can't be 6,000. It is, Stiff. What you see here houses a population of 6,000 people to the square kilometer. But that's ridiculous. How can you do it? That's 20 times as many as our overpopulated land. Your word overpopulation is pure nonsense. Our planet has a population density at least 100 times greater than yours, and we do not speak of overpopulation. I began to feel uneasy. That was madness. I knew it. I should never have started this conversation. It was leading nowhere. I stared with new interest at the picture in front of me and tried to calculate the living space of these people. Strange as it may seem, there were no signs of overpopulation. On the contrary, there was room enough, round the cylinders, and the roads that ran through the woodland areas were in no way obstructed with people or traffic. This is so incomparable with anything that we know that I am at a loss for words. That is the right attitude. With this confrontation with a totally different world, with totally different standards and a totally different philosophy, we are trying to make it clear that you must not draw comparisons. Doing so prevents you from understanding this world and its level of civilization. Forget your own world and try to understand what is happening here. Try, without prejudice, to follow our explanation, as this alone will be difficult enough. The reason for our dense population is the small area of dry land on our planet. Iaga is almost completely covered with water, forming deep oceans, which leaves us with a surface area of dry land which can be compared to the area of Australia, and this is distributed over numerous islands. We were faced with the problem of feeding and housing the billions of beings which we needed in order to achieve our creation goal, on the smallest possible area of land. This imposed the greatest demands on our planning and social systems. These demands do not occur on Earth. You have room to spare. What we needed to create a high level of culture were three things: freedom, justice and efficiency. We will explain these concepts one at a time, beginning with the last, efficiency. You are shocked by the size of our population, but the space surprises you. Strange, eh? It is not so strange when you realize that you are not shocked by the number of people but by the space that is left over in what to you is a ridiculously overpopulated world. You are shocked by our efficiency. To us, it is the most normal thing in the world, because without this concept, we simply could not exist. Without efficiency, our world would immediately collapse. You will continually come up against this concept in our explanations because we must make it dear to you how carefully each of the three concepts, freedom, justice and efficiency, we had to employ to reach the level of civilization that can be called stable. Also, justice is a condition for efficiency. For example, if houses play a part in showing a difference in status between people, then justice fails, and efficiency in a setting such as this is impossible. It demands, therefore, a different, more social way of life. This was roughly the beginning of the explanation of the concept of efficiency, and I absorbed it with some difficulty. Who would expect the description of a superculture to begin with a lecture on efficiency? Anything but that. And it is almost impossible to relate just how efficient they were. Take, for example, their method of planning. It is simply based on the maximum number of people that a given land area can accommodate. The housing and the roadways take up the smallest possible area, not more than 5%, in order to leave a maximum of land for farming and natural beauty. The farming areas produce the maximum in food that their technique allows, in order to support their huge population. The woodland areas are necessary to maintain a sufficient quantity of oxygen in the atmosphere and also serve as recreation areas. Everything is used to maximum advantage. What would you imagine to be the mode of transport of a superculture? You think perhaps supersonic aircraft or rockets, and hovercraft-type ships or hover cars? Out of the question. Anything so inefficient, with so many moving parts which can wear out and require so much maintenance, would be madness on Earth. What do they use, then? Very simple. A fully automatic, robot rail system. Slim torpedo trains that move without creating friction, the only component requiring servicing being the doors, and these are made of such a high quality that they can last at least 100 years. As a well-brought-up Earth man, I didn't give up too easily and pointed out that our aircraft, so fast and comfortable, were surely much better than trains that can only reach a speed of about 400 kilometers per hour. I got the most surprising answers. An aircraft is not only inefficient but is downright antisocial. They only appear on a planet where status still exists, and they are only for the upper classes, because they are useless as a medium of mass transport and the cost per passenger kilometer is at least 10 times that of their rail system. They began to talk about transport capacity. The 6-lane rail system between the house blocks, only the upper layer, can transport 1 million persons per hour operating at maximum capacity. Did I think that aircraft could compete with this? No, I did not. Confronted with such astronomical figures as these, further argument is pointless. They were not yet finished. Did I really think that their transport was slower than ours? Yes, I did get that impression. Well, I was very wrong. I must think in terms of average speed, and the hours that we wasted waiting for connections, delays caused by unserviceability or bad weather and our wonderfully inefficient traffic jams. Having thought of all this, I was readily prepared to believe them when they said that their average speed of all transport systems together was about 5 times higher than ours, inclusive aircraft. Had I mentioned something about comfort? Yes, I had. Wonderful, because comfort was also an aspect of efficiency. Trains had proven to be the cheapest form of transportation, and the only problem that remained was to get as many people as possible to leave their cars at home and use the tram. The only way to do this was through comfort, and this comfort was really something. These trains were shock-free and silent, apart from wind noise. Due to their position high above the ground and their large windows, they offered a breathtaking view of the surrounding countryside, and the interior was so luxurious that it left nothing to be desired. They were unaffected by weather conditions and 100% reliable. The frequency was so high that timetables were unnecessary. Did I now know enough? Absolutely not. It had gradually become dear to me that their understanding of efficiency was totally different from ours. It influenced their very souls. Efficiency had become almost a religion. One of the most imposing visions on the screen was their transoceanic rail connections. A wonderful, orange-colored construction, about 75 feet above the restless green water, crossing the ocean in a dead straight line. I thought at first, perhaps a little naively, that the support towers stood on the ocean floor, but no, nothing so primitive. The whole construction floated, supported by huge balls under the towers which were anchored to the seabed by adjustable cables. The balls were placed at a depth where the water always was comparatively peaceful, unaffected by the conditions on the surface. The question that intrigued me was how the trains could function without friction and wear. I discovered that it was not so difficult once superconductive materials and supermagnets, the same sort of materials that were used for the outer skin of their spaceships, were used. The train was supported on magnetic shoes over its whole length, which ran in a hollow rail. Through the polarity and the strength of the magnetic field, the shoes were held floating in the middle of the rail. A fantastic piece of construction. The system was controlled from large electronic control centers and was almost fully automatic. Optical signaling was not used, so that the speed was unaffected by even the thickest fog. Their cargo trains intrigued me the most, for they were in fact nothing more or less than self-homing containers. The route program was plugged into the nose of the unit and the ghost train left on its journey without a living soul on board, finding its own way over the rail network to its destination, silent and vibrationless, and without lighting at night. Some things were rather amusing. There seemed to be a rather popular pastime that they called traveling in hotel trains. A group of about 25 people would order a unit that was fitted out as a self-service hotel and simply go where the mood took them. Everywhere in the beauty spots were campings, where the trains could stay for a couple of days or more, and all you needed to do to travel further was to program the unit for its next destination. Traveling this way, often at night, they could cover enormous distances. As soon as I asked a question that fell outside the program, I received more of their strange answers. Can everyone afford to go on in this way? No, nobody can afford it, because we have no money, but everyone can go on holiday in this way if they wish. At my request, they showed me one of their cars. In front of one of their huge, glass living cylinders stood a highly streamlined vehicle on ridiculously small wheels. Nevertheless, it could be classed as a motor car. My enthusiasm for motor cars was suddenly diverted by the sight of two Iagan women who, accompanied by four small children, were to demonstrate the car. I sat staring at those strange exotic beings so intensely that the explanation about the car was for the most part lost on me. Their faces were smoother and finer than the astronauts, and they were made up with white and purple stripes on their foreheads and around their eyes. It made me think of Indians on a warpath, and this thought was strengthened by the colorful motifs on their clothing. This clothing seemed to be more for decoration than anything else. It was just a broad piece of cloth with a hole in the middle that fell over the head and was fastened at the waist with a broad belt, leaving the arms and the sides of the body uncovered. Under this garment, they wore a pair of silky trousers which fastened tightly around the ankles. The shoes over the wide naked feet were open sandals. They carried themselves as refined models would, demonstrating the peculiarities of the car with lightning-fast movements. The strangest thing was that their explanation, which I found inaudible, was directed at me, and due to the perfection of the picture I felt as though I was actually present and the center of their attention. "Is this the way your women normally dress? We are showing you to mothers with their children, on their way to a recreation area, and we will follow them with the camera. They are wearing holiday clothing, fitting for a day out. We do not find clothes so important, and as we do not have any other films on this subject, please confine your attention to the automobile." The ladies had, in the meantime, entered the car with their restless offspring, and were demonstrating the maneuverability of the vehicle on its tiny wheels. These wheels only served the purpose of transporting the car from the cylinders to the rail system where, in contrast to the trains, they hung on magnetic shoes under the rails instead of above. This explained the large glass panel that extended under the feet of the occupants of the front seat, giving the vehicle the appearance of a helicopter from a frontal view. The interior was luxurious to wide three-seat benches, and behind, the baggage space. There was only one sliding door on one side, and nowhere could I discover any access to the motor. After this demonstration, the ladies rode away along a broad, ochre-colored road, to where the huge central rail system ran between the house cylinders. The huge motorways, which looked like thin orange lines from the air, were in fact a three-level road and rail system carrying heavy traffic at unimaginable speeds. The top level was a six-track rail system which carried the long torpedoes, the four inside tracks for fast, long-distance traffic, and the two outer tracks for local traffic. The other two levels were for the cars, again using the outer tracks for slow, local traffic and the inner tracks for higher speeds and longer distances. The stations were huge, cross-shaped buildings through which the car tram tracks passed in tunnels. At ground level, around these stations, was a huge bading terminal for the transfer of freight from the rail containers to the wheel transport. The camera continued to follow the fantastic journey along the rails and the two ladies who were at the moment playing with their children. The voice called my attention to the house cylinders. The first thing noticeable from close up is the perfectly smooth exterior, with neither grooves nor joints in evidence. The different floors were visible only as creamy white bands of about 3 feet in height, on which rested glass panels about 15 feet high and 60 feet wide. The panels were met by anthracite grey pillars that ran from top to bottom throughout the whole building. Isn't it rather warm, all that glass in your houses, cars and trains? No, because it is not ordinary glass at all, but a combination of glass and plastic. It contains two electrically conductive layers with which the transparency can be regulated to give a greater or lesser reflective quality. The hologram images crossed a broad river, and I could see thousands of Eargons walking along its banks. I also saw hundreds of small boats braving the strong winds and stormy water. They were catamaran-type constructions, with streamlined cabins supported on legs above the water. The hulls were almost completely submerged, and the strangest thing was that the rough water seemed to have no effect on them. They were fast and made no bow waves. Picture text, cross-cross section of one of the floating and rotating house cylinders. The construction is so stable that despite the heavy Eargon earthquakes, the framework, base, wall, and roof, has a minimum useful life of more than 1,000 years. The plastic flats, apartments 20 by 20 by 6 meter, are removable horizontally. The diameter of the building is more than 300 meters, the height is 135 meters. It provides housing for 10,000 persons, each with SOM2 to themselves, plus a part of the heated communal garden. The smooth exterior is necessary in connection with the strong winds and the rainfall. Comfort and labor saving have been perfected to such a point that the housewife is freed from housework, but the protection and comfort of the house cylinders has become subordinate to the creation of the possibility of numerous human contacts in the utmost freedom. The Camry allowed me no time for further study. The landscape changed. The ground became undulating and in the distance high mountains born in the misty, lazy light of Eargon. The cylinders in their oblong formations continued as far as the eye could see into the foothills and even beyond where the ground was terraced off with long, high walls. As the ground became more mountainous, the buildings stopped, as did the roadway, but the railway continued on through the wild and rocky landscape. The rest of the journey became real science fiction. Like a giant snake, the railway wended its way around mountain peaks and over deep ravines, across fantastic suspension bridges and along vertical rock walls, now over gaping depths and then over grassy, woody plateaus, and in every suitable spot were the stations and the parking areas for the cars. This was one huge recreation area, with its rugged mountains and beautiful waterfalls. Just as we were approaching a large, green mountain lake with nearby buildings, the picture faded and was replaced by the now familiar view of the Eargons' living areas, but I saw it now through different eyes which had begun to notice the wonderful perfection of this strange world, a world that sustained its huge population through utmost efficiency, a world without refuse, smells, exhaust gases, traffic jams and noise. I also began to understand a little of something else, and that was the justice that they were always talking about. Although I had only just begun to become acquainted with this distant culture, I understood that everyone here had equal rights. They lived in the same houses, rode in the same cars and stepped into the same trains. There were neither rich nor poor, there was no separation between nationalities, races or colors. This must be a universally governed planet, but seemingly so strictly governed that everything was streamlined and standardized. What a terrible thought. I had no idea then that my horror at the thought of such monotony was soon to change into longing. I began to wonder what the millions of miles of railroad must have cost. It was certainly a triumph of engineering. Can you give me some idea of what such a transport system costs? That is difficult. We know roughly what a dollar represents in production ability, but to translate that into the cost of a transport system. Well, we can only guess. For $1 billion you would not get much farther than 3 miles. Can't it be done for less? Naturally. But then we would have to make concessions with quality, and that is not our method of working. Such a system can only exist if it is built to last for centuries, otherwise we would constantly be repairing it. We'd never be able to afford such quality. You see it in front of you. What you need is not a vault full of banknotes, but production capacity. Only a society with a completely efficient economic system can realize such things for itself. But can all this be compared to the communist system that we have on Earth? Our cosmic universal economic system can be compared to both communism and the capitalist Western economy. One can also say that our cosmic economics can't be compared with either. If we don't have this system on Earth, how can you call it universal? It is only through this system that a race can achieve a cultural level of social stability. And from there onward toward immortality. It is the cosmic condition, based on natural laws. What's your definition of culture, then, exactly? I'm beginning to think that we define the word differently. That's a very important question, Stiff. Culture is the measure through which a society caters to the least fortunate man. The measure in which the sick, invalid, old or poor people are taken care of. In short, the measure of collective unselfishness. But what has this got to do with immortality? Just this, that unselfishness makes an intelligent race immortal. But before you can understand this, you will first have to climb the ladder with us to the misty heights of comic integration. Unbelievable. I thought that you practiced efficiency as a sort of religion, but now I see that your economic system is a religion of sorts as well. You are beginning to understand, but the word religion is not well chosen. Something like it, then? Correct. Do you mean that to start with we should build the world with this standard of efficiency and quality? We do not remember ever having suggested that you should build rail systems and cylindrical houses, nor have we said that your population should become as large as ours. You are again needlessly creating comparisons, which you should not do, for it leads you nowhere. Try only to understand how we have used the three essentials of higher culture: freedom, justice and efficiency in our world, and what culture really is to us. Only then will you be able to understand our answer to the great question that you have asked. Continues in next audio file.